Hello, I'm Peter Maxwell Slattery, and welcome to the first show that I'm doing, which is the Peter Maxwell Slattery Show. And my first guest is Mary Rodwell. Thank you for being on the show, Mary.
Peter, it's an absolute pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning. You're up at Agnes Water, is it?
Yes, central Queensland, a lovely spot, lots of lovely energy here and quite a few people here that have experiences, which will be no surprise to you, Peter.
Yeah, definitely. What's the weather like there today?
Beautiful, very warm and very much summer weather, although we haven't had much rain yet and we need it.
Yeah, it's sort of like that down this way. So I think it's that time of the year when we do get rain, it's pretty full on too, just being spring.
Yeah, when it becomes the rainy season, we all know
about
it.
Yeah, that's right. Now, you're pretty well known amongst the UFO field, but for those who have not heard of you or may know a little bit about you but not exactly what you do, would you like to explain just what it is that you do and how you got into this arena?
Good question. My background is nursing midwifery, and about 30 years ago when I was in the UK, I was asked if I would be interested in training as a counsellor for a medical practice. So I was intrigued and decided that that would be worth learning and understanding. And I spent 5 years really acting as a counsellor for everything from, you know, grief and bereavement right through to relationship issues. You name it, we got it at the surgery. And it was very interesting for me to come from nursing, which is a very practical profession. We didn't have a lot of time to look at emotional and psychological support, but to see how we could look at preventative healing through people working through their emotions and their feelings. So it was a very good introduction to what I'm doing now in that sense. I came over to Australia, and rather than go back into nursing, I then did more work with the grief and bereavement hospice, working with people, obviously, that had either had a very impacting grief experience, losing a husband, someone close to them, for example, or with someone who was dying and having to face their mortality. So it was a very big journey for me in looking at what this means to people. What happens when we die? You know, how do we deal with that whole thing to do with our belief system, etc.? And continuing that when I worked with pregnancy issues and family issues later on. And it was only really when I got into private practice that I got an interesting range from that. Although in grief and bereavement, you get a lot of people with paranormal experiences, Peter, you know, in the sense that they may have had a very close relationship with either mum or dad or a brother or sister, and then feeling that presence after they died, or they would feel that they were around, or have a sense that they were there as a support or as a guide, if you like. And that fascinated me because I've always been interested in the weird and the wonderful, and had read many books on things to do with life after death, out-of-body experiences, remote viewing, healing, all those kinds of things, and particularly, you know, reincarnation, for example. Yeah. And so these were to me evidence that we lived beyond, you know, the physical. I was very convinced. Not so much through my ex-religious beliefs. I've left that behind now, in the sense that I have a far more open mandate in terms of my belief system. And I didn't want to get tied into dogma or constraints that many religions seem to have in terms of my comfort zone, if you like. I much rather be free with how I explore my spirituality rather than feel tied into any particular dogmas. So for me, this was a very people's personal experience with life after death, or awareness of whether it's an out-of-body experience, near-death experience. That was far more tangible to me than a religious belief in something where you're asked to believe without questioning, where you're given things to believe in. I gave a lot more veracity to people's personal experience rather than, you know, the rules, if you like, that many, many religions have. And what came from that, because I ended up doing hypnosis, was that I was exposed to people going into experiences with their subconscious, and I call it superconscious, where they were exploring what we would term other lifetimes, yep. where they would be different sexes. They would talk about, you know, experiences in maybe medieval times. But also what was interesting is they would sometimes have experiences where they weren't physical, where they would just see themselves as energy, or they would just see themselves as a consciousness of some kind, or in fact seeing themselves as something that wasn't even humanoid, for example. But it was Ellis Taylor, and some of, you know, some of those within ufology will know about Ellis because written four books. You know, he's written about his experiences. And Ellis was my very first client who came to me, and what he said to me was very interesting. He said, look, Mary, I've heard you're open-minded. There are a lot of support groups out there for almost everything you can imagine. But for this, people just think you're a loony. And he proceeded to tell me about his own experiences where he'd wake up with marks on his body, shaved areas, feeling like he was going through walls, being taken onto spacecraft. His partner had similar kinds of experiences, and the children. And he said, look, you know, relatives won't even come to the house because they think it's demons.
Yeah.
You know, and for him, he said, but, you know, the bottom line is that, you know, my partner's terrified. Can you help? And that was really the start for me. Luckily, I had read two books because I'm anything weird and wonderful, Peter, I'd read it. And two books that I read prior to this, and now you and I know about synchronicities. One was the book by Dr. John Mack, the former Harvard professor of psychiatry, who wrote the book Abduction: Human Encounters with Aliens. And what was interesting with Dr. John Mack, of course, is that he was a professor of psychiatry. He did all of the psychological testing with those that he had helped or supported, and really in the end of this said, this is not, you know, mental illness. This is a real experience, and these people are having a real experience. And that was fascinating. On top of that, I read Communion with written by Whitley Strieber. And Whitley, of course, has written many books since, you know, from, you know, Transformation, The Secret School, Communion Letters, a huge amount. And he really did, I think, his books are classic in the sense of the encounter experience or contact or abductions, whatever name people want to use for this. I don't like the word abduction. And the primary reason for that is that many of my clients discover that abduction says it's against your will. And for a lot of my clients, they ultimately discover it's not against their will.
Exactly, yeah.
And it has a lot of negative connotations. I use the word experiencer because you're experiencing an extraordinary encounter or an encounter with non-human intelligences. And you and I know, Peter, that incorporates not just the physical ETs, which, you know, there are many different kinds that people experience, and not just the greys with the bald-headed, you know, black eyes type thing. You get many different types of grey. And one lady told me that she felt or understood there were at least 165 species of grey alone. That's without the blue beings, the mantid beings, which are like insect-like praying mantis beings. There are, you know, many different kinds of lizard, reptilian, lots of humanoids. There are energy beings, there are interdimensional beings, there are transcendental beings, there are those that have no form at all, and some of them very much from seem to be visiting from our future. And there's probably many others I haven't even begun to mention. So what I discovered was that, you know, this is huge. This isn't just the odd person here and there that's having this. This is going on across this planet in different ways with different experiences depending on the soul and the soul's journey. So, you know, I've found that those that have the classic abduction type experience, which, you know, is the one that you see most on the telly being sensationalized, which is the little greys coming at night. And usually it's a threesome. Most of the time it seems to be a threesome. Coming in, the person would be wake up, feel they can't move, and then feel they're being, there may be lights in the room or bright orbs or whatever, and feel they're being taken somewhere, and there's some kind of procedure that may be done, a medical procedure, which may be, you know, genetic material. It may be, as some people don't realize, a healing procedure, and then being brought back to their beds. Yep. And so that is the sort of classic. But the two things that I would want to say here is that even though that's the classic, that's a very small percentage of those that have encounters. Only about 30% of my clients are traumatized. The others are coming from another perspective, which I call the star seed. And the star seed is the one that feels like they're not from here, that feel like their real family is not on this planet, even though they have a human family. They say to me their body feels very dense. They feel that human beings are very barbaric, very primitive. They don't understand the materialistic values. They actually don't understand humans very well, because they feel so different. And what the hell are they doing here? Because many of them feel like they've been dumped. And many of them say, look, I just want to go home. This isn't my home and I don't like it.
Yeah. So, no, you're spot on with that, because from like just knowing it myself, you're spot on with all that. And it's just amazing, because a lot of the time when this, you know, you start to work this stuff out, I think it's sort of comforting when you talk to others and you start to realize you're not the only one that feels that way, because a lot of the time you think you're alone, but then when you start communicating with others going through similar things, it's the same stuff that they like on the documentary that just came out that I did. You know, one of the first things is, I always felt like I wasn't from here, and then there's a clip of my mum saying, you know, what I used to say to her, that she wasn't my mum. And this is something, the other side of this field, that a lot of people sort of just blow off. And it's like you're saying, there's a small percentage of experiences that are having negative experiences, but it seems like as if the UFO field likes to hone in on that more than other aspects. It's like if somebody's crying and they're frightened, they'll go and look at that, and that will sort of get more publicity and looked at. But they're sort of forgetting about, you know, a large majority of the other experiences, which are on the other end of the spectrum. And you've seen it firsthand, both sides, which, you know, that would bring so much to your research and so much to your plate in, you know, working things out. Not all experiences are the same and everyone having the same thing, but you would see so much with what you do.
It's absolutely right, Peter. I think the reason the UFO community has focused most on the fear abduction type experience is because they're the ones that jump up and down and make the most fuss, obviously, because many of them have been traumatized. And they are terrified, some of them, absolutely terrified. They don't know what's going on. They think they're going crazy. They're afraid to talk about it in case, you know, particularly to those within the conventional fields of psychology, because they're afraid they're going to end up in a psychiatric ward or medicated. Yeah. In fact, some of them actually said to me, I would like to think it's me going crazy. At least I can take a tablet and it will go away.
Yes. Yeah.
What they discover is, of course, that doesn't happen. It may dumb them down a bit in terms of what may happen or what's happening, but it still doesn't take away the experience. So it's understandable that that gets more of the profile in terms of ufology. But what isn't understood, or because it goes into a more spiritual aspect of this, is those that have the experiences but not necessarily all the trauma that goes with it, it isn't taken as seriously because it isn't traumatizing them. So is it something that you just want to believe rather than, and it's because we don't always give credibility to the feelings and the knowings of people. We need the tangible. We need, you know, if they're traumatized, then it's real. If they're not traumatized, oh, well, you'd rather just believe that. But what they don't realize is this deep feeling of knowing is very much part of what we need to listen to as well. you know, the dream state of experiences is dismissed many times because they say, oh, well, it's, you know, it's in a dream. The difference between having an experience in a dream state doesn't take away its tangibility. The mere fact that someone's remembered that experience over many weeks or months or years disqualifies it from being a dream, because you don't remember the average, you know, dream.
Yeah, yeah.
That most of us have forgotten it within minutes or seconds of waking up. These are ones that stay with them, and that's what tells you it's not a dream. The reason it's in a dream state, and this is really important, is that when the beings are interacting with you, because of our natural human fear of anything unusual or strange, particularly if we wake up at night and we're seeing these in our bedroom, our first reaction is absolute terror. And there's no way they can take you in that space, because these beings are very fragile. And to be quite honest, we are quite strong as humans, and we could easily, you know, damage them. So what do we do when an animal is in fear, or when anybody's in fear? We tranquilize them.
We knock it out.
We put them into a trance state.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So that is the reason for that. It's not that they're being, you know, what's the word, sneaky. They just know that if they don't do that, they're going to end up being very damaged. So, you know, the only way to do that is to put someone into a trance state so that they will be compliant. The important thing with that is that what a lot of people don't understand is on the craft, there may be genetic material taken, and that's a whole new program. But also there are many healing procedures done. What people discover, that their fear is often fear of the unknown, not fear actually of what actually happened. And when you take them into regression and you ask them, you know, to understand more of what's going on, when they access that, they find out they've been visiting these beings often right from a small child. They are interacting with them. They are being taught by them. Many of the children talk about being in groups of other children, human children, sometimes non-human children as well, hybrids, other beings, and they're learnt to use their consciousness, their mind, in many ways, from using them to levitate things, to using their mind to create things. And I was speaking recently to a seven-year-old little girl who was had mentioned to her mum only a few weeks ago that she'd gone to another place, another planet with these beings, and she was learning how to levitate things. Now, what child of seven knows about levitation unless they've had the experience? This is a seven-year-old talking about levitation. Yeah. And this is, you know, these are things that, you know, the average human child does not know about. And this is my point. There are lots of things that the children and adults talk about that are quite way beyond their human understanding. And this is more evidence of the reality of contact.
Doing what you do, and people like Dolores Cannon, who, you know, I read a lot of her work because it's just blown me out. My brother actually introduced me to her work after I was talking about my experiences, and he said, you know, it's very similar to what she writes and talks about, which is similar, again, to what, you know, you've come across. When you started this out, after Ellis, how long was it till you started to see this picture of the starseed situation and the kids coming in? Like, Dolores talks about the three waves, which has sort of been exposed to me very similar like that. How long was it? Was it straight away, like a straight away type of thing that this came in, or was it, you know, maybe a year or a couple of years? How long did that reality, you know, how long did that take to be exposed to you?
It's a good question, you know, Peter. What started out for me being a counsellor that is dealing with human trauma. So initially, what I was hearing was exactly that.
So you were hearing that back then before you, you know...
Before I got into anything that was broader than that. Initially, it was all about trauma. It was about people having experiences, not understanding them, being terrified, the whole classic abduction type scenario. And what I did was, what was again really interesting and synchronous was, very soon after Ellis, another lady came to me, was having similar experiences. It was almost like once you open the door, everybody and his mother was contacting you. And what I did was I met a social worker through the Australasian Society for Psychical Research, who, because I used to go to their meetings at Murdoch University, and she, a social worker, that thought she was going crazy because she was seeing these beings in her lounge room. Her daughter was having experiences, whatever. And we teamed up and we actually advertised the first abduction support group. And what was fascinating within that advertising that, we got 12 people immediately that contacted us. Now that to me was huge.
Yeah.
It, you know, I thought this was really rare. I thought this was a very, very unique kind of experience. Then all of a sudden there's 12 people saying, yes, I've had this experience. And they were all ages, you know, they were sort of late teens right through to their 60s, if you like. And it was very interesting because then you started to hear a little bit more about the broader range. And one of the things that was important for me, not to put any judgment on this, because, you know, are they, I didn't know, were these beings malevolent? Were they out to use us? I mean, initially, you know, it appeared like, you know, people were being picked up, you know, however, there were all these different beings doing what they wanted in the middle of the night, scaring these poor people, you know, witless. You know, what is this? You know, what is this? But what became fascinating is that when I was working in hypnosis with them and I was getting them to understand more about their experiences, and that's what Dolores does, and not all UFO researchers who do hypnosis do.
Yeah, yeah.
They will often take the person to the scenario, and I'm talking about some high-profile UFO researchers that do hypnosis. Mm-hmm. They will take them to the scenario, in other words, the picture, which is taking somebody, seeing themselves on a some kind of table, seeing the procedures being done. But they would stop at that. They would say, oh, yeah, so, yeah, you've been abducted. There's this, isn't this being. You've seen that for yourself. You know, how awful. You know, off you go.
So, in other words, they wouldn't get the full picture. They would stop there, but they wouldn't dig deeper.
Yeah, they'd say, yeah, you've been abducted. You know, tough shit. You know, get on with it. And there are some top researchers that did that, and the person would be re-traumatized because they would say, yes, now it's actually real. Oh, my God. And now they're coming and doing what they want. So, in other words, you did the X-ray without the surgery in my book, you know, taking medical terms. What's the point of saying, oh, yeah, you've got something there. Tough shit, you know, get on with it. You need to know why you need the surgery. And in terms of that, you need understanding. And this is what Dolores and people like myself, and Dolores is a wonderful lady and a good friend of mine, and often when I was in Perth, she would come and speak to my support group. We discovered we were getting the same kinds of information, and that was there was more going on than what we're seeing in the picture. Yeah. And the way to actually get more of what's going on, I remember reading a book that was written by a researcher in the UK, and I remember the person having experience saying, you just don't ask the right questions. And that stuck with me because, yes, it's no good just saying, okay, so now you've had experience, you can see for yourself through your hypnosis that you've had this, this, and this. Unless you have the reasons why. It's like saying to a 2-year-old, you take to the doctor and you say, look, he's a nice man, he's going to make you better. And the doctor gets a bloody great big needle out and sticks it in the child's backside. The child is going to say, he's not a nice man and I'm not going back there again.
Yeah.
Because they've got no idea what that's for. So, you know, you have to wait till the child's a bit older and they're maybe 5 or 6. And you can say, well, actually, you know that needle the doctor stuck in your bottom? Well, that had an antibiotic that made you better. You've got to know why.
Yeah.
So this is really what the regression has to incorporate. Now, I believe on some deeper level, everyone knows the why, and it's about accessing that. And unfortunately, through hypnosis, when someone is allowing the subconscious stroke superconscious to answer, you get the whys and the reason why this is part of your experience. And that is the bit that you have to talk to. Now, you can do that in a number of ways, as you discovered, Peter, in your your own regression, which was the very first one that you had, on one level, we were talking to your subconscious that was remembering about your missing time, what actually happened. And that was that part of you. I mean, you went to another level because you are already aware of the non-physical realm and your guides and your teachers. And one of them came through and actually expanded on the why. Now, this can happen with some people. It doesn't happen with everyone. With Dolores' clients and some of mine, it will happen. For some, it will stay with the subconscious, superconscious, in the sense that you can then dialogue with the beings in that space. And that's what you do. Because when the person is perhaps it's saying, I'm lying on the table, I don't like it, I don't know what they're doing, then my question to them is, well, ask them then. And immediately you're changing the whole interaction. And the being will respond, or if you want to understand it, that the being's already responded and it's already in the superconscious or subconscious. Either way, they get answers. And if somebody says, well, maybe they're imagining that, some of these answers are so beyond their conscious understanding that they will say afterwards, there's no way I could imagine that. There's no way instantly I got that information. I can't think that way. And I don't think it's that way.
I know exactly what you're saying. And what a lot of people, I think, don't understand with what you, Dolores, and a few others do is that you work on a very, 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 I can't stress enough, deep level where you get to a certain point where the actual conscious part of the mind is just totally, it's not there because you've tapped into such of a deep state where it's sort of you're not really there. It's a higher part of you that's there, and that's the information. And in doing that, that's where, like I said to you after that hypnosis, that like I watched it, and it was sort of hard to watch the second bit because it was like, is this really going on? Because as I said to you, I was out of body watching on into the what was going on at the second half of it. But besides being such, you know, a deep level where you're working at, you don't lead on, which a lot of the skeptics or see being skeptics good if somebody looks at it from open-minded point of view rather with an agenda to begin with, because they can sort of, you know, deviate, you know, bullcrap from, you know, the real deal. But it's very important that, and that's what I always said to Alan and Alan Ferguson and a few other people, that if I ever got it done with how Dolores or you work, it would be the only two that I know of that I could trust, because I know I wouldn't be led on. And, you know, that sort of shuts a lot of the skeptics up, because if they see how, just as an example, the hypnosis you did with me, which is up for everyone to see, you didn't lead me on. And a lot of the time people like you will get hit for, you know, apparently leading on when they don't know how you work compared to others in the past and who are still around. And another thing is too, on top of that, that people have to know is that you might be in Australia, but and Dolores might be in America, but both of you are being contacted by people worldwide. And that's just an amazing thing to add here, because it's not like you're just being contacted by people in Australia, you're being contacted by people worldwide, which just shows that this is everywhere.
You've made some very good points there, Peter. First of all, you know, the fact is that a lot of people are very frightened of hypnosis because they feel that in some way they're going to lose control and that somebody may put in suggestions to influence what they're saying or anything like that. And there's a really important point there, and you're quite right. It's very important for me that I work professionally, ethically, with integrity. I have discovered anyway, there is, in terms of how I work, there is no way in the world that I can tell people to what to say. For example, it's very easy for me to say to somebody in regression, where they're saying they're seeing somebody in front of them. And I could say to them, so what's the color of their hair? And they will disqualify that and they'll say, well, there's no hair. So I can't get them to see hair if there isn't any hair, because they'll say there isn't any.
Yeah.
And then I'll say, you know, what's the color of their eyes? And they'll say, oh, well, they're black. You know, they're not saying they're blue, brown or whatever. they're not, you know, I can say to them, so what's in the corner of the room? And they'll say, well, there's no corners. So, you know, even if I would try and, you know, do some leading, they will disqualify that. And they will say, that's not what I'm seeing. So that's the first thing. And I think it's really important for people to realize that I'm not leading them into seeing something bizarre or unusual at all. In fact, they are very reluctant to say what they're seeing sometimes because it's so bizarre. And they, you know, they're wondering whether they're imagining it because it's just so weird and so strange. And what I say to them is this, you know, there's a difference between imagination and an experience. For example, if you are, if I ask you to remember your bedroom, immediately in your mind's eye, you'll see your bedroom. You'll see where the bed is, where the door is, where the window is, what color the wallpaper is, or what you've got on the walls. Instantly, you will see that because it's your experience. If I ask you to imagine a bedroom, you will have to think about that. You'll think, well, where would I put the bed? Where would the door be? You know, what would I have on the, you know, on the walls? It's a completely different process. And when someone is revisiting an experience, they will actually instantly tell you what they're seeing. They won't spend a time working out what they're seeing because what they're seeing will be instant. And that is the difference. It's a completely different process. And even afterwards, I say to people, look, this is your experience. You can interpret it however you want to. You can see it as symbolic if that suits you. But at the end of the day, you know, when you're having, you know, and even asking questions of the beings, I will say to them, does that make sense to you? And even though it may be very bizarre and very strange, usually they will say to me, even though it's strange, it makes sense or it resonates. And that's all that matters, that they work it out however they want to. And this business of consent is a big one because many people will come into their experience believing they've had no choice. And it's been a really important one because, you know, people say to me, oh, you, Mary, you think they're all benevolent, you know, you all think they're all good and whatever. And I say, look, I've never said that. What I've said is that a lot of the time, what people have believed has been a negative experience, they've often seen a different side once they've explored it. I don't know enough to say anything about who's good, who's bad, and who's indifferent. All I can say is that we're trying to look at this through the through a tiny eye of a needle, and we don't understand there are perhaps many programs, many agendas. And I think it's important that the person does the interpreting, not me. They look at their experience. I will ask, have you on any level, you know, consented to this? And 9 times out of 10, they will then surprise themselves by saying, yes. And I will ask, when was that consent? And they will say, before I came here as a soul, or they'll see themselves as a ball of light. That's not my interpretation. That is their experience. And they can use that as their own way of deciding whether or not this is for them a good thing or a bad thing. What I have said to people is you make up your mind with your interactions, how you perceive the beings. Don't go on somebody else's experiences. Listen to them by all means, but listen to your own resonance to how they experience them. There are people that have had experiences with reptilians that have been extremely loving, extremely wonderful and what have you. Others have had terrifying experiences. So who's right?
Exactly. And I know personal experience that a couple of reptilians I've come across, it wasn't too good, but then there was another type and it was, you know, a tripped out experience because it was totally, it was actually my first experience with the reptilians. It was a really good experience and they were different from the others that later on I did have something with, but you know, I think I've spoken to you about this before, which is more into service or self-service with what's going on. And if they wanted to wipe us off the face of the earth, it would have been done who knows how long ago. But it would have been done. But I agree with you that 9 times out of 10, it's usually, you know, something that's once they awaken to a certain point, they sort of everything sort of activates in the mind of past things and they can see the bigger picture in their part. And that it has been, you know, they've allowed it to happen, and usually that they've agreed on it before they've even come here. So, like you say, but at the end of the day, we don't know what we don't know. And a lot of people come to me expecting answers for this and that. And like I say to people, I don't know. All I know is 0.0001% out of 1% out of 1,000%, which isn't much, but it's a lot more than the average person. But I do not know at all. And anybody that claims they do is just, you know, they just can't. But it's what I've noticed with you, knowing you for how long I have and doing what we've done, is that you're primary concern is with whoever you're working with. You've got no agenda except just to help them help themselves. And I think that's very rare these days in this field, whether it's hypnosis or hypnotherapists or even just the average UFO researcher, where there's ones out there just trying to get their name out there on a certain case. And that's what you do. You know, you do what you do, and your main concern is helping somebody. And there's no better agenda than that, because it's neutral. They get out of it what they want, and they can, you know, interpret how they want. And, you know, what better way to do it and get down to at least something out of whatever experience, you know, those people have had.
Thanks for that, Peter. And you're absolutely right. You know, in counselling, the one major mandate is that you are encouraging somebody in a space of openness and non-judgment for them to find their own answers. There is absolutely no difference for the mandate with extraterrestrial encounters. It's the same thing. You are giving them a safe, non-judgmental place for them to explore their experiences openly so that they can come to some understanding about why this is part of their human experience. And I believe the answers are there. They're within them, and it's about them, you know, exploring that in however they feel they're ready to, whether it's through just gaining more information, whether or not it's through going deeper into, you know, hypnosis to get their answers. In the end, it's what makes sense to them and what resonates to them. And one thing I have said is that we are very good to judge on images, on what something looks like. And, you know, if it looks pretty, then it's got to be good. And if it looks ugly, well, it's got to be bad. We've got to get past that and realize that, you know, something, for example, that can be maybe not very nice can look very pretty, as we've seen with human beings.
Yeah, exactly.
We can see some, you know, you can get some very gorgeous looking human beings that are rat bags, and we can get some poor old soul that's, you know, perhaps not been endowed with a great deal of what we call beauty, that is the most beautiful soul on the planet. Yes. We've got to see beyond the cover. And what I ask people to do with their own encounters is, rather than look at the cover, look at and feel what that being is conveying to you, because that has, to me, you know, the essence of that being. And as we're open to feeling that, we're going to get more of a sense of that being than whatever the cover is, because sometimes the cover's there to challenge us, you know, and it's to get us past, you know, our limits. And, you know, sometimes we have to challenge those human fears, because often, you know, that's why we're here, isn't it? We're on the human journey, is to challenge ourselves, to go beyond our fears, to grow and to change. And, you know, people say, you know, when somebody's had a really difficult life experience, how terrible that is, you know, that, you know, whatever it is that they've experienced, it's painful maybe, or, you know, whatever. But what we know is that often those most painful, most challenging, most scary experiences that we have are often the times when we grow the most, when we change and we learn the most. And it's from those that we say are bad. Are they really bad, or are they just painful? Through that pain, we become different. So is that bad? No, it's painful, but it's actually when we grow the most. So we've got to get away, I believe, from the judgment of, is this good or bad? One of the things that was interesting in the way that Duncan Rhodes, in his last presentation at Nexus, said something really interesting about judgment. And he said, you know, we judge things because of through our limitedness. For example, he said, you know, there are some things that live in a way that is the only way they survive. For example, if you've got a tree with a parasitic weed on it, for example, you know, you might look at that parasitic weed that's living off the tree as something bad, but all the parasite is doing is trying to survive. It's not deliberately trying to take from the tree. It doesn't know any other way to survive. So is it bad? It's, you know, it's still trying to survive. And a lot of, you know, we see that as bad because it's taking from the tree, but all it's really doing, it's not trying deliberately to harm the tree. It's just trying to survive. And so I think we need to look at, you know, all those different intelligences out there from a perspective of, you know, is it really a negative agenda or are they just like us trying to survive? You know, I think it's about openness to experience. And I think it's about openness to allowing ourselves to get away from judgment as much as possible and seeing things in the most objective, neutral way. That is the way we grow, when we can see things from as many perspectives and honor them all as valid. Let's face it, we can all see a car accident and we'll all have a different perspective on it. This is the same with these intelligences. We've got to now start looking at things as openly as we can if we ever are to communicate and learn and grow from our galactic visitors.
Well, you're spot on with everything you just said. And when you look at the, you know, the actual situation of it all, or just to do with, you know, this field in general, it's funny that we don't know much more from the 50s and 60s up until today, unless you look into what you're, the type of thing you're doing and talking to experiences, because the science and all that type of thing and the way the research is conducted, whether they use Geiger counters, they work out the measurement of the craft, how big it is, which really doesn't matter anyway, because, you know, the craft's still not there. Trying to prove, debunk photos, or videos, whatever. It's funny that that side of the field is basically back where it was in the 60s with NICAP and all the research groups that were around then, and then, you know, a lot of other groups. But when you look into this, and because I think it's not out there, but because it's not the norm for research in the UFO field, this type of stuff that you talk about, that I've experienced and I talk about and write about, it's sort of looked down upon. But like I say to people, you should be talking to experiences, and I say this to a lot of researchers, because they might find something more than just doing your average textbook research, which, you know, it hasn't got them anywhere. And this isn't putting them down. The subject wouldn't be looked at how it is today if it wasn't for those type of people and groups and Dr. J. Allen Hynek and all, you know, all the old school people. You know, I've got heaps of praise for them, but it's getting to a point where it's, you know, it's getting nowhere. You know, after, you know, 60 years or whatever it is now that it's been looked at in that way, it's got nowhere. And I think Allen Hynek, by his later years, actually started looking at the metaphysical aspect. And he was saying to people in private, you know, this is, you know, there's something to this. But, you know, a lot of people too in the field have got high credentials, you know, Stanton T. Friedman, you know, nuclear physicists and other people that have got prominent roles in society or whatever. They don't want to go too far. It's far enough that they've gone into UFOs, but anything else, you know, just stay away from it. But the type of thing that you do, Dolores does and many others do, it sort of gets down to the nitty gritty of working more out than, you know, what you can with crafts. It gets down to why this is happening. Not that we can grasp the full picture. I don't think we can while we're in a human body. But like you were saying before about the parasitic thing in the tree and all that, that sort of thing starts to open up the oneness in people's minds, how we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the sun and the moon, because the moon slows down the wind around the earth and makes waves and all that type of thing. And everything affects one another. And, you know, is something really that bad if they're doing what they're doing just to survive? And that's sort of a glimpse just to show the oneness, how everything is interconnected on the physical plane. But once you get into out of the physical plane, you can see how the dimensions or densities are all connected, how we're all actually one consciousness interacting with each other. And doing what you do brings this type of thing to the forefront, and it helps people grasp things, especially like the book you wrote, Awakening. And that is one of my favourite books, and I've been telling everyone about it because I, reading it, I was just like, there is not a book out there like this. There just isn't. You know, you've got people that write about their experiences, what they do with hypnosis. Yours covers a lot, and it's sort of like a handbook guide, a 101 for an experiencer or somebody who thinks they've had an experience, or tools just for an experiencer to deal with what they're going through. And this is, you know, that was a fantastic book, which I just want to talk about quickly. What got you into wanting to do something like that that was different from the norm?
It's a good question, and thank you for your comments on that, Peter. What, when I really got into this, the one thing that I noticed was the numbers, that the questions were often the same every time with someone who phoned me. It was, you know, am I going crazy? How do I know this is real? What does it mean? How do I deal with this? Who do I go to? What do I do about the fear? You know, I think I've got implants. What are they? You know, all those kinds of questions that come up once you, you know, you feel this is part of your reality. And I couldn't find anything that would be, if you like, a manual that would help people to go through this process in the way that I think it was going to be helpful. I wanted to make it easily read. I wanted most people to understand it. I wanted to use language that most people could understand. And I, you know, I also wanted to use a few case studies to give people an idea of how this experience is for different people as well. So that was where, you know, the book, the inception of the book was, because as you say, there are a number of people who've written about case studies. You've got people who've written about their own personal stories. But there are a lot of people right in the middle of nowhere, you know, that have nowhere to go, no one they can trust to talk to, that need to have something they can work from if there's not someone around. And as you know, and you mentioned it, a lot of the UFO groups are great with lights in the sky. They're great with the more tangible stuff. But for goodness sake, don't start bringing in people that mention they're having interactions with those lights in the sky, because they didn't. And I think some of it was because they didn't know how to handle it. They hadn't got the skills, you know, because a lot of these UFO groups are amateurs. You know, they're coming in because of their own experiences or because they've seen stuff or they're interested, but they didn't have the skills. One of the great things that I did have was I knew how to deal with human trauma, in the sense that I knew how to support people with human trauma. I'm a qualified counselor. So, okay, so let's look at answering the questions. And what was interesting about writing Awakening was that I started at the beginning. Okay, how do you know this is real? You know, how do I know this isn't a hallucination or a dream or whatever? And I went through all the things that you get the debunkers and skeptics coming up with, you know, are it sleep paralysis, you yeah. know, one of the favorites, yeah. you know, it's fantasy prone, or, you know, or they just want to be different, you know, because that, you know, they want everybody to know about them or whatever. And I mean, the favorite is, you know, how do you know that somebody coming to you is having real experiences and they're not just imagining it? Do you think, I mean, this is one of my favorites with the media. Do you think that people travel hundreds of kilometers? Sometimes they've come from another country to see me, you know, the US or the UK, spending, you know, thousands of dollars to see me on a fantasy,
yeah.
to tell me their story? And who am I that they should care whether I believe them or not? Of course they don't. They come because they don't know who to go to, who's going to listen, and who's going to allow them the space to work through this or understand it on some level. I mean, what people don't realize is the ones that are the most skeptical are the ones that have the experiences, because they want to prove to themselves they're not crazy. And in fact, they'd rather often think that they were, because then with any luck, there's a tablet that makes it go away. No, they come to me because they actually want answers, and they'll spend a lot of money to do it. And you don't do that because you want to imagine it. And you certainly aren't looking for publicity, as you well know, Peter, with the slack that, you know, the hassle you get from media once you do go public, how they love to make fun of you or yeah. you know, mock or whatever. You don't do this for publicity. Yeah. You know, it's not famous, it's infamous, more like. So, you know, I say, why do you think people come? Because that this has been a mystery all their lives. You know, some of them still afraid to go asleep at night. You know, they may have children having experiences that are the same. They're coming because they need to have answers, or they're seeking answers. So what I did was I worked out the most important things that people wanted to know. Is this real? How do I know I'm not crazy? What do I do about the fear? What if my kids are having these experiences? What, you know, who are these beings? How do I find out what they mean? You know, missing pregnancies are, of course, a big one. You know, the implants, what about these? And then it goes into, through the process of getting some understanding and me offering people tools, you know, how do I know who to go to? Is the researcher better than a therapist? You know, the difference between a researcher and somebody who works with hypnosis as a therapist supporting you. If you want, you know, a lot of people expect a researcher to be everything. You know, the researcher is someone that's going to tell you about other experiences that people have. It may, they may want to know the dates, the times you've seen a craft. They may want to know, you know, any other things, any tangible things that you have experienced, anything they can verify. But they are not, most of them are not trained in counseling. They're not trained in therapy. So they're not there to help you understand from the deeper levels. And it's unrealistic to expect them to do that for you and could give you emotional support. So if you want emotional support, you need to go to someone who understands the phenomena that will help you work from a therapeutic point of view. And that's completely different. Their focus is trying to prove that this has veracity. The therapist is a therapist first, and secondly, a researcher. So my focus is helping you to understand your experiences. If through my research, I can see patterns from others that have might have experience that will help you verify yours, then that's the bonus to it. But I am a researcher second. I'm a therapist first. I'm there to help people understand what's going on in a way they choose to understand it and not how I choose to understand it. That's not the purpose of somebody coming to me. They have got to work it out for themselves. But I can tell them, for example, that, yes, others experience this, other experiences that. Now, again, the difference between a researcher and why I think a lot of UFO groups are no longer growing in the way they should, unless they start taking in the broader panorama of this experience, because it's no good still looking at lights in the sky and proving that the that what you've seen has been real and you've got witnesses and what time it was and all the rest of it. People want to know more about why these beings are visiting us. And if you've had an experience, it's not enough. Yeah, you've got it. You've got loads of footage on, you know, the reality now. Every 6 minutes around the globe, someone's taking pictures of UFOs and what have you. Average people with cell phones and all the rest of it. We know they're visiting. We need to know now why. And we need to know why they're interacting with people. Now, the thing that people don't realize in terms of tangibility, yes, it's important to have the tangibility. But it's if an experience is changing you, then it's real. A fantasy doesn't change you. You can fantasize about UFOs and whatever. It won't change you intrinsically. What is evidence of a reality is when it changes the person forever on a spiritual, psychological, emotional, and physical level. And this is exactly what happens after an encounter. People change. Oh, yeah. And again, that is evidence of its reality. Whether you want to acknowledge that or not is up to you, but that is all the evidence you need. People don't change after fantasies. They change after encounters. That is the reality. You know, even if they don't bring you bits of the craft afterwards, people change also very intuitively, as you've found, Peter. You know, you found you've become more intuitive. You are able to sense energies. You're able to perceive different things. Your whole physical reality has become more multidimensional. That is evidence, absolute evidence, that what you're experiencing is real.
Oh, definitely. And people don't even think about what the families of, you know, the experiencer go through. And I think one of my best bits of evidence for my family, besides, like, lately, now everyone's seen something around me. like lately, you know, family members, everyone's seen something by now. It took a while, but they've seen it. But going back to when everything's, you know, I started to be awakened, I see people now from 5-10 years ago, and they just say, you're not you. They say, you're better. Like, they just, they know talking to me that this isn't the bloke they knew. And the my family could see that, and still to this day, I'm, like, awakening every day, which I think all experiences do. It's just never ending. And it's a beautiful thing once it gets to that point. Up to that point is very rough because, you know, a couple of years I had no one to talk to. But that's one of the best bits of evidence. And, you know, it's something that if researchers did, you know, they went and if the family wanted to and if the experiencer was okay, you know, say, talk to my family about it, they could get first-hand testimony to how much this person's changed. And every facet from how you treat people to the environment, your health, every single area of your life is absolutely changed. And that is, you know, testimony within itself. It's just really hard, I think, just for researchers to grasp, especially with the, you know, a lot of researchers think these beings are just ET. And I know from experience that some of them are from under the earth. Some of them are extraterrestrials in this dimension from somewhere else. Some are extraterrestrials from another dimension. And some are time traveling. And once you get that far, even after the first thing, you've done their head in because their paradigm's just stuck in one thing. And if we, like you said before, if we researched it, or if they researched this from a neutral ground, like as if doing a cold case just started over, there would be a lot of things brought to the plate. And the book that you've done has done that on a level like that, where you've looked at the whole gamut. And as an experiencer, I read that, and there was every now and then I'd come across somebody's experience in the book, and I'd be like, that's happened to me, but I've never thought about it. And it kept on happening. And it really tripped me out because I was like, how couldn't I pick this up for myself, that this just wasn't right? And the way you've done it is just beautiful, because there's nothing else like it.
Thank you. It means a lot, Peter. I think that I was, there were a lot of synchronicities, even to the actual publishing of the book, where I was saying, well, I've written it now, how do I get it out there? And through a number of synchronicities, the particular publisher only published two books, and one of them happened to be mine, and it was published within the space of 3 months, which is unheard of. So, but every time I was doing a different chapter, what was fascinating for me is I would get phone calls all about that chapter. Yeah. You know, it might be, I don't know, implants, and people would be ringing me up about implants. It's almost like I was being fed the information I needed for that particular chapter. And it would literally go like that all the way through. It was just bizarre in some ways. It was really trippy. I mean, that was the thing that got to me. It's almost like someone else was helping me to write it. And I trusted that because I'd suddenly think, oh, yeah. And that'll go in and whatever. And I hope this one's okay. You know, it was just like that. But what I wanted to do was to eventually show how I was exposed. And, you know, we talked about this bigger picture of the star seeds, was I was getting more and more of those with a different kind of perception of their interactions. And it wasn't fear-based for them. For them, it was different. For them, it was finding it really hard to be human. And where you got, I mean, I got one woman tell me who I discovered, and when people say, oh, well, they come to you, they expect to find out that they've had experiences. And I said, no, that's not true. I had one particular case that I mentioned where the gentleman was a young man who'd had an experience on a motorbike where he'd had concussion, and he'd never remembered how the concussion happened. And he came to me via my daughter. And he said, look, I'd like to know how I had this accident, because I've never remembered why it happened or how it happened. And it was fascinating because it was almost like one of these mysteries, who did it, when and how. Each time I took him to a space where he'd get a little bit further with his motorbike, where he got it to the point where he was going down a lane and he would be looking at the trees, and he would then, and then it would all go black. And then we'd start again, and he'd go a little bit further towards the buildings that he remembered in the country lane and what have you. But the thing that blew me away was at some point he'd stopped the motorbike and he'd said, so I said, because I was still expecting to see when he was going to actually have the accident, you know, whether, you know, he'd gone over a tree or something or other or something weird. And he just stopped it. And I said, okay, so what are you seeing now? And that's when he said, I'm seeing a spaceship. And I said, where is it? He said, directly above me. And I'm thinking, well, did he have the accident when he saw the spaceship, you know? But no, he'd actually got off the motorbike before he was taken up into the spacecraft. Now, this was, I was in very much, you know, I was running on the seat of my pants by this time because I'd got no idea where to go with this because this was totally unexpected. And, you know, this is a young man, I had no idea about my other work at all. We find out that he's had a procedure done. He mentioned what the beings were like and all the rest of it. He then is put back down. He climbs on his motorbike. So he's still not had the accident. And it's on his way home. He doesn't see something sticking up out of the ground. And he ends up going, you know, topsy-turvy with his motorbike and destroying part of the carburetor. And that's when he ends up going home with no memory. So he'd actually had the experience, the bike accident, after he'd been taken up on the spacecraft. So when he comes out of this, I'm just as gobsmacked as he is. And he's going, oh, my God, what's that? And it's only when I then talk to him and I hear more and more that he's actually had encounters all his life. And he hadn't even had any idea. He hadn't had a clue that he'd been having experiences, not a clue. And it was only through this regression and this, you know, going back to his accident that we actually found out the truth of what had happened. Now, this isn't, you know, when people say to me, oh, they want to believe they've had an experience, they want to see themselves as ETs or whatever. It's absolute crap.
I just don't know anybody who would want this. If, like, I just can't, like, being an experience of myself, I just can't picture how somebody would want this. Like, to me now, it's all pretty cool,
exactly.
But I just don't know who would want this, especially in the starting phases of what we go through, the awakening. It's very hard. You get scared, crap, you know, shitless sometimes. It's, you know, I don't understand how that question could be, you know, even asked sometimes. It's, yeah.
But, you know, it's amazing how many of the media will say that, oh, you know, they just like a little bit of it. They're looking for attention or a bit fantasy prone or they've got a great imagination. I tell you what, some of the things that people have explored in regression would make them the best, best sci-fi writer imaginable.
Yeah.
Because it's so incredible. Some of the things that they experience when they go into that to that encounter or whatever are so way beyond anything that I've ever read. And I love sci-fi. Honestly, they would make a living at it with no problem whatsoever. And these are ordinary people. You know, when you've got a five-year-old, and I remember, again, it was somebody who came to me because they thought that they'd had some kind of abuse as a child. And she didn't know about my other work. She'd come to me because she knew I was a good counsellor and that I worked with hypnosis. And this lady went into an experience where one minute she was, you know, she'd had some kind of abuse as a child, but the next thing she's seeing herself on a spaceship. And what people need to understand that 5% of sexual abuse is actually can be connected to ET experiences because they do take genetic material and it can be physically intrusive. And they can sometimes that is actually ET related. But anyway, this lady found herself on a spaceship. And again, she came out of it saying, what the hell was that? Interestingly, her daughter, a few weeks later, I don't know how it came up, but a daughter out of the blue who was 5 said to her, you know, Mum, you're not my real mum. My mum, you know, my family's in space. And the mother was quite shocked to hear this. And she said, what do you mean? She said, well, she said, I don't really look like this. And so her mother said, well, she said, I look different on the inside. And her mother said, well, you know, can you draw me what you look like? Because she didn't quite know what to make of it. And her daughter said, no, because you'd be frightened. And this statement of, you know, you're not my real mum or you're not my real parents, so you're here to look after me. I would love a dollar every time I hear that from some people.
Yeah.
Because I would have somebody already who's paid my rates, to be honest, because it's like it's so common. And it's something that many of those that I've spoken to talk about. This Mike Oram in England, who wrote his book, Does It Rain in Other Dimensions? That was one of the things that he had said, you know, my family's in space. And he, you know, it's a very common statement. Now, the thing with the traditional nuts and bolts ufologists is why they struggle with some of my work and Dolores's and others is because we're taking it into more of a spiritual realm, if you like, where we're honoring feelings and knowings and dreams, which aren't as tangible. And it's much harder for them to quantify that and feel it's acceptable in mainstream. But in the end, you cannot deny these are part of the patterns of contact. And it's just as important as evidence in my book as whether or not you bring something away from the craft or you've got pictures of the UFO that you've interacted with or, you know, you've got marks on your body or you've got implants, which, you know, all those things are useful for giving it a tangibility. But we've got to understand, too, there is another tangibility. I mean, for somebody who's had an accident or a trauma on this planet, for example, say they've had some kind of abuse as a child and they talk about it later. Do we say, oh, you can't prove that to me, so therefore I don't believe you? Because they may not be able to prove it. They may not be able to have the person responsible there in front of them, or the person may in fact deny it. So do you say, well, it's not true then?
Yeah, exactly.
What's evidence of their experience is the trauma. You don't get traumatized by nothing, you know.
Exactly,
you don't
right.
have knowings about nothing, you know. So if that's okay, if somebody's been traumatized and you see evidence of trauma, you know something's happened, you know. So why is that different for somebody who's had ET experiences? Why is that suddenly not okay or not evidence? It's nonsense.
Yeah, it's just the way of thinking sometimes in this field is just like that. For example, a lot of people who write into UFOs and researching, they will use, because you've written a book, they will use that against you. But if just say you were a lawyer or you're a tennis player or whatever and you wrote a book, that would not ever be brought up. Never be brought up. Mm. And this is the frame of thinking which needs to be changed. And the experiences, like especially with me, the spiritual side, the psychic side, all this type of stuff, what happens from it is just unbelievable. And there is a huge spiritual telepathic point to all this. And it, you know, like what got me was that everything wasn't physical. There was the, you know, the astral part to it. And we go back throughout history, and this is brought up over and over again, whether it's in ancient scripts or whatever, there is that point brought up. And it's just something people don't want to look into. And I don't want to tell anybody what to do. If anything, I'd just like them to have an open mind, like I have an open mind listening to them. But this is something where there are a lot of answers that, if, like I say to people, don't talk to just me or don't believe me, I'm pretty cool with that. But if you talk to enough experiences that haven't even talked to each other, you would find cross-correlation things where it becomes beyond a coincidence, which I believe there's no such thing as a coincidence anyway. But this is just something that's not done. And you've been able to do that through finding patterns in your work and in your research of what just, you know, things just cross-correlate.
I think that's all we've got, Peter, is the fact that there are patterns to this, no matter what kind of experience you have. Some have, you know, more patterns than others. I remember very distinctly getting a very emotional gentleman in his 50s contact me. And he contacted me first to say, you know, that he basically one-liner. And I sent him the questionnaire. And he was so profoundly moved by the questionnaire. He phoned me and he was literally in tears. And he said to me, how do you know about my life? He said, I've never told anyone about my experiences. I've never felt safe to. I've never felt able to. He said, so this is something so personal to me on so many levels. And he said, it's just like, I can't believe. He said, it's like you've been here watching me all through my life. And he was literally in tears over it. And I said, look, the only reason I have put the questionnaire together in the way that I have is because I am seeing patterns of this experience. And it's so much broader than just seeing a UFO. But the fact that he'd related to that in such a profound way at least is verification of its importance. But more than that, is every time I do an interview like this, I never know who it's going to reach, Peter. And there's been a few times I've had really very distressing emails, in the sense that I feel the importance of this information. A number of times I've had one lady wrote to me from the US, and she said, you've just saved my life. And in her email, she said, I had virtually given up. I was about to just end it because I felt so alone. I'd given up on this, my life here, I felt nobody understood. I felt totally isolated. And I happened to hear your interview, and I'd forgotten who I'd done it for. I've done so many interviews. Yeah. And she said, and you'd literally spoken about me. She said, what I felt like all my life, I thought there was no one like me. And she said, and actually it stopped me finishing my life. And I just want to thank you for what you're doing. Now that's like, it is quite confronting to hear that. And it's actually not only humbling, but it's also quite, it makes you feel in some way, you know, quite the huge responsibility in a way. But at the same time, I'm grateful. I'm grateful that I have the opportunity to at least share something that can, you know, help on whatever level, you know. And I think that's why we're all here, and why you're doing what you're doing, Peter, is because, you know, what we're talking about and what you're sharing so openly and so generously is, you never know where that's going to go. You never know who is going to hear that, because there are so many people that are experiencing this. And I'm not talking about a few hundreds here, or even a few thousands, or even a few millions here. I think this planet is being activated. I think consciousness is being activated, and we're all experiencing it in different ways. And I think, you know, this isn't just a few here and there. This is big. This is so big we can't even imagine. And every time that we can put out that this is, you know, what's going on, we never know where that's going to go. I mean, when I get people contacting me from countries that are non-English speaking, for example, Russia, South America, France, you know, Norway, Sweden, you know, Alaska, I mean, they are often, a lot of them are non-English speaking. And yet somehow or other, they found my presentation, or they've heard this in a, you know, and it's not their language, for example, but feeling like they've had to contact me because it's part of their experience and whatever. That is telling you how big this is. You know, when they've gone to the trouble of translating it or trying to find out what you're talking about, for example, that's how big this is. And that's why it's so important you're doing what you're doing.
Yeah, and you too. Like, it is so big that I thought, like we've talked about before, once you think you get something, that idea and that what you think that reality was is totally blown apart and 100 times more complicated, but more beautiful and bigger than... And then it happens again once you think you've got that figured out. And looking at this whole thing now, I'm just not surprised by anything anymore. And I know that I don't know at all, because it just each time... And I had a bloke the other day, another experience, is saying, I'm getting it all. I understand. I said, don't say that, because I said, in the next few days, something's going to be thrown in the mix, and you're going to realize what I'm saying. And But it is a beautiful thing. And I think right now, looking at the global population, we are seeing bad things happen, but it's exposing things on a way like it has never been done before, especially with governments and just the way banks and corporations, everything's done. And, you know, 10 years ago, you couldn't really talk to people about that type of thing, you know, forget the alien stuff for a second. But what I've worked out is lately, people have been bringing this type of thing up to me. They're seeing a change. They're seeing something different. They're seeing how we're getting screwed over, but they're seeing how we're, you know, people are getting sick of it and that it's up to them to do something about it. You know, it's like I say, you know, don't try and change the world out there. Work on yourself. And enough of us to do it, the more people will start to do it, and that will, you know, project and manifest outside of ourselves what we want. And it's getting to that point now, and it's a beautiful thing.
You're absolutely right. I do believe that humanity our collective consciousness is now waking up out of that very limited third dimensional dream. I mean, at least now scientists are acknowledging that, you know, that there is a multidimensional nature to reality. It's no longer, you know, unless it's solid, we can touch, feel and smell it, that it's real, that there is a non-physical reality. If we call that the hologram or the, you know, the, you know, quantum science now is, you know, is really telling us the quantum understanding of reality and how we are all connected through that consciousness is being acknowledged as something that the science itself is now prepared to explore, at least those that are a little bit more comfortable with acknowledging what they don't know, if you like, whether or not it's to do with parallel realities or parallel dimensions. What is it? String theory is talking about 11 dimensions. There's probably much more than that. Constantly learning about, you know, the nature of reality and the expanding universe. And, you know, so at least the more forward thinking are acknowledging now what is time. You know, we're being taught that maybe everything actually that's a linear construct of a third dimensional world, and that time and space and everything is all happening actually in the now. I mean, if that's the case, you know, that gets us to think of things like everything we call past in a different kind of way. So we're being challenged on every level now to at least be open to possibilities, because we don't know what we don't know. That's one of my favorite sayings. So how can we dismiss it if we don't know? What you know is possible? We don't know what's possible. We don't know what's impossible. And like you were saying, you know, that as new information comes in, we have to expand even more. And I often say that my reality is like an ice floe that I'm standing on, and I'm standing on it for the moment with this reality, and tomorrow I might get new information and that ice floe is going to melt. I'm going to have to find another one to jump onto as it keeps melting. You know, it's continually, as you know, we're continually growing as we understand. And, you know, I think that is, for me at least, the healthiest way to explore the mystery, which is the mystery of who we are, what we are, where we come from, and yeah, where we're going. All those amazing questions that we all end up asking once we go down this particular rabbit hole.
So true, so true. Well, I'd like to thank you for being on the show, and I'd like to have you back sometime too.
Absolute pleasure, Peter, anytime, and good luck with this. I think it's a brilliant idea, and I know that you're going to get some amazing people speaking on this and helping this planet wake up. So well done and congratulations, and I'll be very happy to talk again some other time.
That's muchly appreciated, and what I'll do is I'll put a link up to ASERN on my website so people know where to go or to look for more information. And, thank you again very much, and we'll talk soon.
Take care, Peter, and well done.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.